true and haughty whore of the first water, and they cannot think what to do. Chapter 17. Mrs. Flowerday's eyes do not leave the person of Angelica Hancock, even as she dumbly shifts her baby from one breast to the other. The child, feeling the nipple tugged from his mouth, lets out a little whimper, and Angelica's lips open a fraction. She looks at the little frill of his cap, and his ear so perfectly and miniaturely moulded, and the crease of fat that forms behind his frail little neck as he burrows at the breast. Even from across the room she can smell him. He is warm and dry, fragrant as if he has been baked, a malty and milky little child. Suki rises. She puts her hand in Angelica's. She says,
"Come, will you not sit with us? We have all been waiting for you."
But Angelica stands erect and apart. She remains for one moment longer, her chin up, surveying her audience, before she is satisfied by her opinion of them and walks with slow certainty to her seat. Her skirts hiss about her. Nobody moves until she has finished shaking them into place so that not one fold will be crushed beneath her. Then she leans on her elbow to inspect Mrs. Flowerday's son.
"I did not know you had a child," she said. "Suki, you did not tell me there would be a child."
Despite herself, she cannot stop staring at it, the way one stares when a man is thrown from his horse, or a litter of kittens is consumed by its mother. She would look away, but she cannot.
"My husband's house, my house is in Braintree," gabbles Mrs. Flowerday. "And Mama attended me there, but my lying in was so fiendish boring that as soon as I was fit to travel, I brought baby a-visiting."
The queenly Mrs. Hancock does not remark upon this, so she finishes lamely.
"And here we shall stay some weeks more, I hope."
"She missed her Mama," crows Mrs. Crawford. "She's married so short a time, dear little girl. She cannot but miss her family."
"And Greenwich," says Mrs. Flowerday, "for I had such society in Greenwich before I married, and my husband courted me there so prettily. I was the sensation of the season, and the countryside is rotten dull, blasted dull."
"Now, Caro," warns Mrs. Crawford,
but her daughter begins to chatter again, explaining that baby is in fact no trouble on long journeys, certainly no more than a lap dog, and in fact less trouble than a lap dog, since he stays where he is put. He even seems to enjoy the rhythm of the carriage, bless his dear heart, and she must beg leave to recount an anecdote of a funny expression he once made, and to describe the extraordinary smallness of his toes, and to recount the many arguments she and Mr. Flowerday engaged in while deciding if it were to be William Edward or Edward William. And all the while, Angelica is staring at the back of his little capped head with awful fascination. Her heart feels small and dense, as if it were dough clenched tight in a fist. She meant her dress as a charm against fear and dismay, as it always was before. She wished to be once more Angelica Neal, who prospered and was gay. But although the gown is the same, it seems the lady has altered. Still, Angelica Hancock shares with Angelica Neal the knowledge that it is better always to be fierce than to be sad, just as it is always better to fight than to run. Therefore, when Mrs. Flowerday stops to draw breath, Angelica interjects,
"Do you not find it tedious?"
Poor Mrs. Flowerday's eyes widen.
"Tedious? Why, no. Why, perhaps when you have children of your own." "Who says I have no children?" "If you did," says Mrs. Flowerday with triumphant finality, "you would not say they were tedious."
Mrs. Flowerday, for all her talk, has sharp eyes. She is herself no stranger to the tête-à-tête section of Town and Country magazine. She is well acquainted with what affairs this splendid woman has left behind her.
"And she is not so very beautiful, for all that," she thinks to herself. "She looks tired for a woman of such notorious leisure."
She had hoped she might be coarser in her manners and speech, but Mrs. Chapel's training is thorough and deep ingrained. Angelica cannot be faulted in any respect of taste or conversation or appearance, although Mrs. Flowerday had not thought it quite usual to dress up so for tea. But things may well be different in town. Lord knows it is long enough since Mrs. Flowerday herself has had the pleasure of going there. Most of all, as her child's muscular jaw grinds down upon her nipple, and she curls her toes in her shoes to keep from crying out with the pain of it, Caroline Flowerday is watching Angelica Hancock in order to ascertain whether this is a woman who might ever tempt a man like Mr. Flowerday to forget his duties. Her lovely bosom, her translucent gown, the graceful way she moves her hands in speech and the musical prettiness of her voice, is this what he would spend his money on if he had the opportunity? Is this the sort of woman he might keep in London? For how can she be sure he does not, in rooms furnished from the Crawford dowry? Are the ties of desire as binding as the tie of a little shared child, and of the prosperous future promised therein?
"Surprising," she says, "that you and Mr. H. have none yet."
Mrs. Hancock is silent for a moment.
"We have only been married half a year," she says. "Half a year? It did not take me nearly so long. But then you are a little older than me."
The baby is drifting into sleep, the movement of his lips slackening to nothing. She looks down at him proudly and nudges his cheek, which sets him off sucking energetically again, his eyelashes brushing his cheek.
"Look at him go, the dear little pup."
She looks up.
"It was a fine wedding. We had a procession all across the heath, and all the children from hereabouts wave ribbon wands, and the horses had flowers plaited into their manes. I suppose yours was splendid."
"In my old parish church," Angelica remembers the cold flagstones of St. Anne's, the names of the dead carved deep on the floor of the chancel where they stepped.
"We felt no need to make a spectacle of our feelings."
She wore white kid gloves. Even so, she felt his hand tremble in hers. It is as slim a splinter of memory as any from her childhood. It feels nothing to do with the life she has now.
"But how peculiar! Nothing has happened," says Mrs. Flowerday. "We were not a minute alone before..."
"Now then, children come when they come," says Mrs. Crawford,
but she has taken a practical and sociable interest in the bearing of children for close to 30 years, and sees the opportunity to dispense advice.
"I suppose this is your first marriage," she says with matronly authority. "You would be surprised how many young brides are inexperienced in these matters."
"Mamma," says Mrs. Flowerday warningly, "do you not recall our talk this morning?"
Even Suki puts aside her anxiety and leans forward, rapt at the escalation of the conversation. Angelica considers. Her face is serene and lovely, but it has a rigidity to it that only her niece sees.
"That's so, Mrs. Crawford. No man but Mr. Hancock ever called me his wife. But I cannot think that inexperience is to blame. I had more men than I can keep count of, you know, and the number of babies whose beginnings I was compelled to end. Well, it cannot have done me any good."
She does not drop her face. She almost smirks, as Mrs. Crawford sets down her tea bowl with hands so unsteady it dances on the saucer.
"Oh!"
says the old lady, fumbling with her handkerchief, and she takes a breath and brightens.
"But we are all ladies together now. Surely it makes no odds to me what your past transgressions might be, since you are repentant now. And as I always say, let it be God's concern how harshly he will come to judge you, for it is not mine."
"I had best warn you, I am a woman of great wickedness. I was a celebrated whore for 10 years, says Angelica triumphantly.
But Mrs. Crawford is dogged in her piety.
"It's remarked that I am uncommon in my liberality, but those are my principles."
She clasps her hands, returning gratefully to her topic, for she is convinced she may yet discover a helpful insight into the Hancock's childlessness.
"What of your husband's history? At his age, he was surely not a bachelor."
"A widower," Angelica says.
"Oh, hear that, Jenny?"
Mrs. Crawford nudges her sister-in-law.
"A widower? That is something for you to think on. For all the men you missed out on the first time round will be in want of a new wife before too long."
She chuckles and pats her hands together.
"A widower, Mrs. Hancock. A fine choice. A good steady sort of a husband. Less inflamed by romantic passions, which, mark my words, can be more troublesome than enjoyable. His character revealed and his fortune already made, which bypasses many of the trials one comes upon in the early years of marriage."
"And less need of a bridal portion, which is so troublesome in broadcasting a lady's value to the world," adds Mrs. Flowerday.
"Yes, a very practical choice," says her mother. "I always think second wives are more of a practical necessity. The first is the true partner."
"But this is the importance of a dowry," says Mrs. Flowerday. "'Tis what yokes man and wife equally. When my Edward has one of his foolish ideas, I tell him, 'Sir, do you recall through whose beneficence this will be paid for?' That gives him pause."
The child is flopping in her arms like a drunk. She passes him back to her aunt to be winded and tucks her breast back into her gown. Thus straightened, she smiles at Angelica.
"Of course, when a gentleman is as wealthy as your Mr. Hancock, there is nothing to stop him from taking any bride he chooses, however obscure or poorly thought of."
She raises an eyebrow.
"Nothing but propriety."
"I hope you do not mind my saying so," says Angelica kindly, "for I'm sure you mean nothing by it. But, Mrs. Flowerday, your choice of conversation gives the impression of small-mindedness. Spiteful, some might read you. Perhaps even vulgar, which I'm sure cannot be the effect you intended."
She squeezes Mrs. Flowerday's hand.
"I tell you this as a friend," she says, "and as a woman just a little older than you."
Mrs. Crawford shuffles contentedly in her seat, pleased that a lady so metropolitan would condescend with her insights. Jane Crawford, mopping a milky rime from her charge's lips, says nothing still. But for the first time, a great smile springs across her lips until she buries her face in the child's soft neck, and it is hidden again.
"And now," says Angelica, "has baby run through his entire repertoire, or is there more? I'll gladly sit and watch him for another hour. His performance is quite equal to anything I saw Garrick do. But if there is to be a song or a tragic piece next, I may need a short interlude in which to compose myself."
"And what would you have me do?"
she asks Suki, after their guests have departed, at speed and with many lamentations.
"There's no point in my trying to be what I am not. I am a fraud, and all can see it. Why would I not conduct myself as I know how? "You are very rude," says Suki. "Pish posh. They would have me stare at a baby for 2 hours. What was there to be done? Think of your husband, the impression that this gives." "Oh, my husband." She curls her lovely lip, the most Angelica Neal expression she has shown for a year. "Why am I always to think of him, when he never thinks of me? Miss Suki, if he did not intend to give a certain impression, he ought not to have married me in the first place." "I've no argument to that," says Suki. "You never got him under false pretences." She feels rather excited at the prospect of real glamour residing in this house. The meek Mrs. Hancock who arrived in Deptford, at last restored to her splendour. "I will look over the books," she says, "and find the wages for a proper hairdresser. 'Tis criminal that you are attended by nobody and do not look as you ought." "Oh, Suki, Suki, dear heart," Angelica kisses her face. "You understand me. I never felt so much myself as I did this afternoon." Chapter 18. By night time, with her face wiped clean and her hair sheathed in its muslin cap, she feels less certain. The afternoon was as a masquerade ball. The words spoke from behind a mask may be bolder than those uttered barefaced, but this need not mean they are more honest. She stews in the bed, small and lost. By the time Mr. Hancock enters, it is the very dead of night, and no light whatever intrudes the room. But he has memorized his steps well. Angelica listens to him moving about. By this sound, she judges he is putting his wig on its stand. By this, he is removing his jacket, and then his breeches. When he comes to the bed this time, she does not pretend to be asleep. Her bravery persists. She sits up from her pillow and pins her eyes upon his shadow. "You're awake," he says.
"Yes."
He nods, but says no more. His silhouetted profile shows clearly his down-turned mouth, his cheeks with the grim slackness one observes in a death mask. What has happened to him that he has grown so grave and thin? He raises his arms, and the movement of his fingers tells her he is unpinning the jabot at his throat. She bides in quiet agony at how changed he is, how all his affection seems evaporated. And when he puts on his nightcap, she resolves to pursue the matter.
"Sir,"
she says.
"Would it be different?"
She waits. She does not like this question. She does not care to hear its answer. Already the weight of truth is heavy and tight in her stomach. She is glad she cannot see him.
"If I had had the child, would things here be different?"
He pulls back in perplexion or surprise.
"Why, of course. Everything would be different."
And then he gets into the bed beside her, and they say no more. Later in the night, as dawn approaches, he stirs. Angelica's slow breathing fills the room, in and out, pacific as tides.
"Poor child,"
he thinks, but nonetheless he cannot stop thinking of the mermaid, her great voluptuous sorrow rolling over in the vat. And although his wife's tears lie heavy still on his heart, he cannot help but go from the bed.
"Why do I do this?"
he asks himself as he makes his way through the silent house, the air of the vast staircase dancing with secrets of its own.
"Why not stay with her?"
Because the call to leave is so beguiling. This is how a man feels at the top of a great tower. He is afraid of the abyss beneath him, but still he must look upon it, and still step towards the parapet.
He passes through the dining room and out of the glass doors onto the steps. The garden is a rustle, the lawn a dark triangle stretching down to the white smudge of the summer house, and he strides out towards it. He pauses a moment behind the columns of the folly to let the silence settle. Satisfied, he unlocks the little rough door that leads down to the grotto. But when it creaks open, he hears most distinctly a sound that makes his ears prick up, and the bristles on his neck quiver. A door. Slammed. It comes from inside the house. He steps backwards into the shadows, but even so he sees one window become illuminated. The glow of light travels from one first-floor window to the next, and then vanishes again.
"My wife," he thinks.
Perhaps she is hungry and goes to the kitchen to find an apple or a lump of cheese.
"She will not come out here."
He hunches like a gravestone. He can hear his own breathing fearful loud and the trembling and ringing of the vat.
"Do not come out here,"
he orders Angelica.
"Do not. Do not."
The air is so still. He hears the front door of the house open and close, as if it were at his ear, and her feet moving over the gravel.
"She will look at the front of the house only. She will look at the stables to see if a horse is gone. She will not come back here."
But he hears her voice.
"Mr. Hancock?"
And then she comes glimmering around the side of the house. She holds a lantern close to her bosom, her hand cupped about its frail flame.
"Sir?"
His blood throbs, his heart is pinned to his chest, its spasm surely audible. He holds his breath and takes another step backwards. But there is something under his foot, a dead leaf or a bird's decayed wing, that betrays him with a crunch. She stiffens, then darts, her shawl and her nightgown and her hair flying behind her, as if her movements leave a pale residue on the air. She is running down the lawn, but is still some distance away. She cannot see him from his vantage point.
"Where are you?"
she cries, moved suddenly to anger, and surges immediately towards the summer house, her lantern swinging high.
"I will have no more of this!"
Although she is very close, she cannot quite discern where he hides, and he is able to look at her for a good long time as she stops before him, her hair standing out as if it were electrified, and her feet spread and her face furious. The dawn light makes her unfamiliar. There are dark blooms in her eye sockets and under the shadow of her hair. Her skin is luminous here, greyed there. She is panting hard. He hears her swallow with exertion or fear. He cannot tell.
"Here I am," he says quietly.
"What are you about?"
she demands.
"What are you thinking? Creeping around at all hours. Never here when I seek you. And what secrets you are keeping, I cannot begin to think. If you mean to drive me to madness, it is very skilfully done."
She waves her hand with such energy the lantern goes out. She drops it to the ground with no further thought.
"Enough! I demand your behaviour changes, or I will quit you. Do not imagine I will not. I do not need you, sir."
"Come away,"
he says, hurrying forward. He takes her wrist.
"Come indoors. We shall talk about it. Whatever you wish to say, I shall listen to you."
She is craning to look past him.
"What have you down there?"
"Nothing."
He pushes her onward.
"Not nothing. I ought to know my outbuildings. I am mistress of them, am I not? And yet I never wondered why you kept the key to that one. What is it?"
"Come away. Do not raise your voice. You will wake all the household."
She pushes him away.
"And what if I do? I have nothing to hide from them."
She lunges into the stairway and almost loses her footing. He hears the shale scrabbling down, and then she, still not three steps in, says,
"Ow!"
"Be careful," he says. "The stairs are very steep. The light is not good."
He takes up the lantern from the grass and reignites it with shaking hands. Then he approaches behind her, holding it aloft to light her way. She is poised on the steps. She touches one mussel shell, then another. She traces their bull's-eye circles.
"What is this?"
"Go inside," he says,
and she advances slowly, he following behind, and her hair in the cold breeze washes back upon his hand. She descends and descends, and in the chamber exclaims. Something has happened there in that earth-enclosed chamber. The sorrow pours from the vat as if it were steam or smoke. It is invisible, but it churns in the air and fills the lungs. There is the simultaneous sensation of being so full of grief as to choke with it. And yet an emptiness, a dreadful, lonely, howling void. She seizes his hand convulsively.
"Be with me! I cannot bear it!"
And turns to him, fearful.
"What is this?"
"I do not know," he says. "It came from the sea."
"It is a trick,"
she says, not too far gone to remember her suspicions. But then she turns this way and that to look at the lions, the peacocks, the fans and arches, all picked out in so many thousand shells, and how the lantern light flickers over them so they seem to creep. The shine of the pool in the furthest chamber sends reflections of its ripples scurrying over the walls. In the dark, everything moves. She thinks a great hand has seized her. The feeling is, she cannot say, longing or grief. That thing which is called by sailors nostalgia, whose sufferers sicken for their home and fade away still weeping for it. And if they have no home to go to, it hardly signifies. The pain is just as deep and sweet. Her footsteps are loud and cold on the flagged floor. She tips her head up, and her sigh resonates off the vaulted ceiling and comes back to her own ears 100 times. It rolls also around the belly of the great copper vat, which crouches black and unadorned.
"Is it in there?"
"Look," he says.
He keeps a 3-legged stool nearby for his nightly communions with the creature. But Angelica rejects all assistance. She hooks her fingers over the rim of the vat and hoists herself upward with all her strength. She can only remain for a short moment before her slippers give up their grip on the copper and her arms tremble too violently to hold her. She turns to him, her fright compelling her, as ever, to anger.
"Water?"
she spits.
"No. No."
He spreads his hands. "The moment has come."
"That is your mermaid."
Her poor face expresses 1,000 feelings and none. She shakes her head and knots her fingers.
"I have thought for some time," she says, "that one of us is becoming insane. And I feel more confidently now which of us it is."
But she looks about herself. She does not believe it.
"Please, look again. Your mermaid came. It is real."
She twists her face.
"Real as Mrs. Chapel's. Real as a dead ape ever was. I am finished here, sir."
He reaches out to her.
"You cannot pretend this creature has had no effect on you. Let me help you up, and you will see what I see."
He steps towards her with his arms outstretched, not a gesture she has known for some time, and this is why she acquiesces. Holding his shoulder to steady herself, she scrambles onto the stool. Her slippers are thin and precarious. She wobbles, but she is up. She leans over the vat and frowns.
"I see nothing," she whispers.
"I swear."
And she is quiet. She leans forward as still as a figurehead, hair ruffled by the breeze that has played through those chambers for who knows how long, and was born nobody knows where. Her eyes are dark and downcast. Her fingers dig into his shoulder, and he feels the tremble of her arm as she holds her weight steady.
"What do you see?"
he asks.
"I see her."
"And?"
"When I was a little child," she whispers, "I lived by the sea. On stormy days, I would go to the wall at the edge of the harbour and look at it. I sat very still, as I am now, and I would stay there for hours."
The wind outside picks up and comes hissing down the hill, stirring the grass with its invisible fingers and sweeping down into the grotto. Her arms break out in goose flesh.
"It was so buoyant," she says, "energetic and terrible. I was so afraid of it that sometimes all I wanted was to leap into it."
As the first streak of dawn nudges the horizon, he nods.
"Yes, you do see it."
She does not alter her position, but her whole body trembles, for it is a cold night to be abroad in only a shawl and a cotton wrap.
"What are we to do with it?" she whispers.
Chapter 19. By the time the sun has come up, and they have quit the mermaid's lair for the house beyond, Angelica's doubts are all flown away.
"I will have it rule us not 1 minute longer," she declares to her husband.
They have not slept, but sat together at first, simply wondering, and she asking many questions, and he shaking his head and sighing.
"I cannot say. I do not know,"
while she becomes increasingly giddy in her relief.
"But this is the cause of our misfortune," she says, "and where the cause of a trouble is plain, there can be found a way to set it right."
"I cannot find it,"
he says tragically.
"Oh, can you not? Well, that is just like you."
And indeed, there is only one present in the room who has made a living of thrusting through disaster.
"It may all be set right. We are neither of us dead, are we? And all our household fine in fortune and fettle."
She rings more vigorously for the maid than she ever has hitherto in this house.
"We shall need rolls and chocolate to eat here. Yes, here, in this very dining room. I shall not hide away in my rooms any longer. Hurry, hurry."
Then, still in her night attire, she sits by him at the broad, polished table by the French windows to eat. Her sleeves are rolled up, and there are crumbs on her cheek, but she appears as composed as one of the old queens of legend preparing to do battle, and spreads her hands flat on the tabletop as if she stood over her campaign.
"Your judgment in concealing the creature was very poor, I think. You should have told me at once. We must devise a plan by which to deal with this creature as firmly as possible."
"Can we not simply?"
"No," she snaps. "We will do nothing simply. I outlaw simplicity from this moment forth."
Her muscles quiver.
"I am going to check this creature. It will pay for what it has robbed me of."
And indeed, in the face of its gusting despair, she feels the most invigorating hatred. If it had been a tangible thing, a beast or a man, that had attacked her contentment so, she would have flung herself before it and fought with all the strength in her body. But there is no doing such a thing, and so she is frantic for action. How may the thing be controlled? How may she exert her will upon it? How is such a creature's power diminished? To the maid, she says, "Fetch me notepaper. I must write a plan."
"A plan for what?"
asks Mr. Hancock. She looks at him as if he were touched.
"A real mermaid, sir? A true curiosity, and you meant to hide it away? There is no denying the veracity of this creature, whatever it is."
She flicks her hair out of her face and looks up at him, smiling imperiously.
"I shall display it."
"Now, Mrs. Hancock," he says, "I cannot think that is a good..."
She opens her eyes wide.
"Oh, why ever not? I am mistress of it, am I not? It belongs to me."
"I acquired it."
"For me."
"For you, but certainly I had no idea."
"I cannot imagine what else you thought I would do with it."
She reaches to him.
"I shall parade it, like the beast it is, like a tiger with its teeth pulled out, or an elephant all addled in the head. Everybody can come to stare at it and see how powerful it is, and yet how helpless, trapped in its horrid vat and buried under the ground with us, its masters."
He twists his face.
"You're afraid of it,"
she says.
"It is dangerous."
I shan't pretend it's not, but I am going to find a way to crush it."
She bends over her paper and then looks up again, alight with pleasure.
"And so, think what people will make of it. All those who cast me off. And I shall certainly invite our neighbours, the Crawfords."
She feels a sharp and savage delight when she considers Mrs. Frost's fright, Mrs. Chapel's confusion, Belle Fortescue's quiet bafflement. They will be unsettled. They will be undone.
"Oh, I will show them."
She scrawls madly all the society names she can recall, the fine people of London and of Greenwich, and then, indeed, all the great ladies of the demi-monde, and the shipwrights of Deptford, and the niggling Crawfords and Flowerdays of Blackheath.
"Well, they will see what I am made of. Here, lists, invitations. Send for an engraver, the best. A stationer, somebody who can design me a very, very fine card."
"Must it be displayed? Is it not better to conceal it? It does awful harm."
"Just for one evening, sir. I've no intention of opening a menagerie. I only want people to see what I've got."
She looks up into his face, all beseeching.
"Just one party. Very exclusive. Here we are, in this great house, with our great fortune. Well, the time has come for me to be a lady. Besides, I own the beast, and since it seems to have had no compunction about exerting its powers over us, I see no reason why I may not do as I please with it."
Still, he hesitates.
"Do you really think?"
he tries, but without conviction, and in fact partially to provoke her retort, which is swiftly forthcoming.
"You have no say. 'Tis my mermaid, you are my husband, and you must merely stand by me. Oh, they will never believe it."
Seeing her so much herself again strikes a thrill through him.
"We must proceed, quickly, very quickly, before everybody leaves London. I'll not wait for next season. Now, do I have your leave to spend as I see fit? You may be quite easy that there will be nothing to reproach in my decisions."
"I leave it to your judgment,"
he says, and she smiles as she has not smiled for a great long time, and settles down to her preparations. Chapter 20. Your company is desired at the house of Mr. and Mrs. J. Hancock on Midsummer Night 1786
to observe a mermaid.
The invitation is printed on thick ivory card and is more border than text. Angelica has had it decorated thickly with scallop shells, writhing dolphins and bare-breasted sea nymphs. The lines are so crisp and black, the ground so velvet soft, she cannot stop looking at it. It is simply the most perfect and precisely formed thing she ever saw.
"I think I shall have one framed," she says.
Mr. Hancock looks over her shoulder.
"That is not what our mermaid looks like," he objects.
"Oh, the picture is merely there as an assurance that the thing exists. It is for them to come here and see for themselves whether it is true to its portrait or not. Besides, how would you draw it? Get away, get away. Leave this to me."
"How it will be made enticing, I cannot think," he says to himself,
and he leaves hurriedly before he can think any more on it at all. Angelica now comes to make use of her small retiring room, laying out a pile of cards on her desk and filling her inkwell for the first time. At first, she only sits before them, regarding her own efficiency with great satisfaction. Then she sets about her task. The first card she writes is for Belle, and she inks the title carefully, sorry that hers is not a more beautiful hand. She writes on its reverse,
"Truly, dear, you must come. You will be astounded. I'm sorry to have seen so little of you."
Chapter 21. The former Mrs. Fortescue has had a deep-tiled bath built in the basement of her house at Chiswick, and here she may be found several mornings a week while she resides there. She would do it even more often if she could only shake off the suspicion that full-body immersion must present some risk to her health. There is at least no possibility of the water leaching poison through her pores, it being beautifully clean and steaming and steeped with sage and chamomile and other herbs whose essence might very well be absorbed to her great benefit. It comes up almost to her shoulders. She propels herself with her feet on the bottom, and her shift puffs up with air and inflates about her chin. Her hair is bound up and covered, her face scrubbed clean as a little child's. She is stripped, in short, of all possible identifiers, and unashamed to drift there quite as God made her, an arresting little person with her small, full mouth and long-lashed eyes and stern, dark brows. Of less pleasure to her, but surely no less as God made them, are her aching back and feet and breasts. The child quickening in her belly is cause for rejoicing, but her discomfort is not. If God had made her with gills, she would stay in the bath all day. In come her maids, all gowned and bewigged.
"Are you ready?"
"Aye, yes."
Belle's head in the puff of her wet chemise drifts to the steps. She strips naked and the two women chafe her down with coarse linen sheets.
"What post for me?"
she asks, leading the way into her resting room, which smells of roses and Castile soap and where a fire is burning and a white-draped bed made up. She always reads her messages after her bath.
"Three letters this morning."
And they each seize an arm and rub her well with lovely unguents. They are brisk and vigorous in their work, and she relaxes into the squeeze and slacken of their hands over her elbow, ribs, the backs of her thighs, and the smart dome of her belly. Then the one woman helps her don a fresh white work shift, still warm from its pressing, while the other measures out drams of strengthening tincture into glasses as fine as sharded ice on winter puddles. And she perches on the bed to take her doses, and at last pivots her legs up and reclines. There are hemispherical windows high up in the wall, and all about their frames on the other side of the glass blow filigree leaves of Herb Robert and Forget-Me-Not. Yonder is the bluest of skies, and from time to time the feet of gardeners tramping past. She rests a hand on her stomach and reaches for her letters. Shuffling the envelopes, she recognizes the hand of Angelica Neal, who is now Angelica Hancock and in her own great house. Lady D, Belle Fortescue, as was, gives a great smile. Chapter 22. Suki is at a loss as to what can be happening, except that all of a sudden Mr. and Mrs. Hancock are never about the house. They abandon her to her walking lessons, while they do she daren't think what at the far end of the garden, or vanish to London for the day, returning with mysterious crates and preceded by endless wagoners delivering more of the same. She is dully acquiescent to being shut out of such intrigue. Her loneliness and melancholy increases day upon day, until she can suppose it no less natural than the other curses of womanhood she has been rudely surprised with these last few years. One morning, however, she awakes at her accustomed hour and hears a sound to which she is perfectly unaccustomed, the rhythmic swish of four strong men swinging their scythes in time on the damp lawn. Peeping between the window frame and the fold of the curtain, she further observes a master gardener in wire spectacles move stoopingly behind the team with his golden shears to snip with infinite studiousness any blade left tall. And furthermore, upon descending, she finds the house below is suddenly fierce and busy, with footmen everywhere and lines of hired women called up from Deptford and Greenwich to roll up their sleeves and do unguessable things to the folly on the lawn, which to her knowledge has remained firm locked since the house was bought. They file down the hill, laden with buckets and brooms and brushes, and emerge some hours later, weeping into their aprons.
"What's afoot?"
she asks Mr. Hancock, who is reading a newspaper in the library. He is hunched deep into his chair, but even so there is something more expansive about him than she has detected in some time. He seems almost to smile when she comes into the room, or at least he troubles to turn up the corners of his mouth.
"Something very strange is happening," she says.
"My wife," he says with hesitant hope. "She is solving all our problems. At least, she says she is."
"Excuse me?"
"Go, go," he wafts his paper to her. "To the folly. You will find her busy in there. Quite extraordinary things, dear niece. She means to reverse our fortune entirely."
Suki squints at him. He is certainly altered. He wears an air of fragile optimism, as if he were at last recovering from an illness that has diminished him for many months, and the blood once more returning to his cheeks.
"Uncle,"
she asks,
are you happy?"
He reaches for his pipe and sets about packing it.
"I believe I mean to be."
She hesitates.
"I've not seen you so in a good long time."
At first she thinks that her observation has angered him, for he pauses in his activity for a moment and gazes without seeing upon his pouch of tobacco. Then he reaches out his hand to her.
"Here. Come."
She lingers yet some yards away from him. To speak would be to betray her emotion.
"Do you think I have forgot you?"
he asks softly, and in response she only tips her face down.
"I forgot everybody," he says. "But I will remember. I am remembering. And when I am restored to myself..."
"Then you will be happy with her."
And Suki finds herself racked with great distress. For what is she but a spare daughter, a fortuitous pair of hands to be sent wherever life cannot be managed? She strives always for harmony, for order, for contentment, That is her usefulness. But where it is restored, her usefulness ends.
Must I live all my life in this manner?
She wonders.
For how long can this be borne?
Aloud, she says.
I know you will send me away.
Still he reaches to her and observes, she knows not why.
Perhaps it has got to you too, Suki. Suki, have I not had sorrows in my life before? And were you not always my first joy?
A secondary joy, she thinks. A compensation for those he lost.
She shakes her head.
I do not know, sir. I cannot say.
But crosses the room to him and cautiously takes his hand. He squeezes it hard.
You have a place here always, he says. You are my family, and Mrs. Hancock's too.
She can do nothing but squeeze back and look in the other direction and mumble.
Perhaps.
Not perhaps, most certainly. Even when I had little else, I had you. You think I shall abandon you now?
He pats her hand and releases it.
You are mistaken. Now go on with you. See what my wife is about.
She ventures into the garden with great trepidation and steps apologetically past the gardeners, who are now wheeling in a number of white-painted classical statues to place in the wilderness behind the folly. Suki has never spent much time at this ornamental and neglected end of the grounds. She has certainly never before noticed the little wooden door at the back of the building, which now stands wide open, the voice of Mrs. Hancock clearly emanating from within.
"Higher up,"
she is saying as Suki descends the stairs.
"Just so, just so."
And she enters the darkness of the first great chamber, in time to see a bright apparition whisk across one of its walls. Suki is astounded past speech. She never saw such a place, and situated under her very home. And yet, the strangest thing of all is the vast green mermaid, fanged and terrible, that hovers upon one wall, its edges all radiant with strange light, its body knobbled and quivering. It looks so very much like the mermaid brought to Union Street that Suki staggers and gasps. But Angelica is laughing and clapping.
Oh, bravo! That is how I wanted it. Lights up now. Suki's here.
Some hired woman lights the sconces, and here is Angelica, as finely made up as ever she was in her life, a blue sash in her heaped hair and dolphins embroidered on the cuffs of her dress. She looks at her niece's face and clasps her hands with joy.
Now that is the effect I wanted! What are you doing here?
Enjoy my grotto. Look, I've had transparencies made up.
The gentleman who works the magic lantern holds out his work with pride. Suki cannot but admire the glass sheets painted each with underwater creatures. Here a whale, its tail flipping joyous. Here a school of bubbling fish. Here a terrible mermaid, and here a voluptuous one with long tumbling hair.
So lifelike when projected. You were afraid. But see, see what else I have done.
Angelica leads her forth, and indeed the changes to the grotto have been most extraordinary. A chandelier is rigged to the vaulted ceiling, and one alcove has been fitted with cool marble shelves, upon which are arrayed goblets of Bristol green, and a vast punch bowl painted with goldfish, and decanters of every sort of spirit.
Musicians will go in here, says Angelica, leading her through to the next chamber, whose walls are lined with elegant little chairs, all painted with dolphins and putti. Although the sound wants something, and I shall have real tanks of fish, and there will be dancing while the illuminations shine over the walls. Can you imagine what fun it will be?
What is this for? Asks Suki.
What has come over you? Darling, dear heart, you do not know. I have finally been brought my own mermaid.
Angelica shoots a vicious little glance at the furthest chamber, which flickers a strange green light.
I own it, and I'm going to show it to everybody.
She begins to gabble.
Our meeting with those Crawford women set my mind right. I am a grand lady now, and I must behave so. A lavish party is the sort of thing I can do very well indeed. I have until Midsummer Day to have this perfect, so you will forgive me if I pick no fruit with you today.
Is it in there?
Asks Suki. She has grown bolder, but there is something about the space that troubles her. She feels here a great and peculiar lostness, one she remembers from the day she was taken from school, and again when Bridget would not accompany them from Deptford, and again when Angelica Hancock touched her toe to the fallen plums and pronounced them all rotten.
Aye.
But Angelica's pride is evaporating a little.
I want to see it, says Suki, and would march straight in if, from the darkness within, a great and awful sob had not just rung out.
Suki backs into the arms of her aunt, and a hired girl rushes blindly from the chamber, racked with tears and beating her breast as if she were bereaved of somebody precious. She careers from the grotto before they can stop her, slipping and scrambling upon its steps, and groping at its walls for the blindness of her tears.
"What is she about?"
Suki cries.
"Is she so afraid of a magic lantern?"
She steps forth to call after her.
"It is only a painting, you know, only a bit of trickery."
All in a moment, the jubilance has leached from Angelica. She tugs at her finger joints, her old vulgar habit.
"Silly girl,"
says Suki, and heedless of her aunt's altered mood, advances again on the chamber. Angelica swoops towards her and seizes her arm.
"No, no,"
she says.
"Allow me in,"
Suki argues. The room breathes something mesmeric. She cannot help but peer within and pull towards it.
"I want to see." "Come, dear," says Angelica, all of a flutter. "I think perhaps you should not see it until the place is quite done. It is not as I would like. You know how particular I feel about these things."
She has, for the first time, a misgiving. She thinks, "No, I cannot wish this thing upon an innocent girl."
"Let us go above." "But what sort of creature is it, really?" "It is a mermaid."
She is pleasant and even as she walks her niece to the steps, but her heart is uneasy. She feels as if she shepherds her away from a great danger. "Do not turn back," she wills her. "Do not go in there." She finds that she is shivering, and recognizes the strength of will she has exerted in order to remain composed in that chamber. She thinks of the hollowness in her husband's eyes, and what vast grief rolled over her when first she contemplated the mermaid in its tub. And she feels again the urge to cast herself between the creature and the one she loves. Her fists, in fact, are clenched, her teeth gritted as she locks the door behind them. She will not have this creature touch her niece, no, not for one second. As she moves up the lawn, Suki appears to regain some sunshine, and her questions become more prattle than impulse.
"No, but what?"
she asks.
"Is it alive?"
"You must wait and see."
"And you are to have a party?"
"'Tis my intention." Angelica puts her arms about the girl's narrow shoulders and squeezes her briefly as they stroll together up the hill. "But don't you look until I say you may. I am mistress of this house, do you remember? Now come,
come, back to the house."
And once they are within, she is gripped with a terrible relief. Chapter 23. The invitation, delivered to Mrs. Eliza Frost's nunnery, finds quite a different scene. A gentleman has lately complained of a certain heat and tingling in his organ, such as very often betokens the growing displeasure of Venus.
"He has visited no place but this," she says, striding before her girls, who have been all gathered together in the parlour for an interrogation. "And so one of you must be the source of his affliction."
The girls are at their most innocent at 11 o'clock in the morning, which is their time for sewing and French conversation. They stare at her, but none dares open her mouth, for they are all mightily afraid of the whip they have seen propped in the corner of her chamber.
"Speak up," she says,
and her shoes click as she paces from one to the next, inspecting their faces for signs of guilt or lesion.
"Which of you is it? Stomach ache? Pains? Foul secretions? One of you knows what I am speaking of. At least one of you."
They shake their heads, most honestly, since none of them suffers a thing.
"If you do not volunteer yourself, it will be the worse for you. If you have gave it to one gentleman, you will give it to another, and word will spread, and then who suffers?"
None of them can say.
"I suffer," she bellows. "My name is besmirched. Not yours. You were never any better than you ought to be. Nobody will be surprised that a whore is dirty, but I am a businesswoman, and it is my reputation you destroy."
She stalks back to her spot in front of them all. Spittle glistens at the corner of her mouth.
"Would you have us closed down? And you all thrown out on the street?"
They shake their heads.
"No, it is not pleasant out there. Not for a girl all alone. And yet that is the danger one of you has chose to put all your sisters in."
She looks from girl to girl.
"It pains me that one of our number would be so disloyal as to bring us all so close to penury."
She pauses to study the effect of her words. The girls are agitated. They do not move about, but they fret where they stand, for everywhere is the tremble of embroidery and the flutter of books, and the girls who have nothing in their hands suddenly feel a great desire to touch their faces, or to put their hands to their own throats. Mrs. Frost narrows her eyes.
"Can you guess what else I have deduced from this?"
she asks.
"No. One of you,"
she points from face to face,
"at least one, has broken a rule. What is our first rule?"
At last a question they can confidently answer. All to a woman, in tone,
"Sheath up."
"Sheath up," she claps her hands. "Sheath up, indeed. If you all made use of the armour provided at a very reasonable rate, we would not have mishaps like this."
She brings her voice to a sing-song nursery rhyme bounce, as if she were talking to infants or idiots.
"A gentleman has caught the clap, and it is to my great embarrassment that this occurs immediately after he, having a great deal of influence in the running of this city, has undertaken a great favour to me. He protects us, and you have infected him."
A footman appears with a silver tray on which are piled a number of wax-sealed letters.
"Put it on the table for the present," says Mrs. Frost,
gesturing to the heartwood bureau at the far end of the room.
"I shall read them when I've dealt with this trouble."
It is a large room with a hard-polished floor, and the footman sets out upon it, his feet tap, tap, tapping, while the girls watch him in dumb desperation. Tap, 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 he goes, and at last lays his tray down with a muted clunk. Then tap, tap, tap on his expedition back to the safety of the landing, and a row of female faces follows his progress like a field of sunflowers. Once he has retreated, one of the longest-serving girls clears her throat. She has been a streetwalker since she was 13 and is loath to stir up trouble. But her senior experience outstrips, although she does not think of it, even Mrs. Frost, who has had a single lover in her whole life, and he of little enthusiasm. This girl clears her throat again and speaks up.